CliffCentral.com.
All right, we are running deep into the Thursday here, 17th of October. Thank you for joining us here on the Gareth Cliff Show without Gareth Cliff, which I know so almost sounds like false advertising, but it's fine because there's lots of other quality here. My name is Ben Karpinski. I am hosting the show today. We've got Gugu running the production booth, making sure everything goes out, the podcast, all that kind of stuff.
Plus, you'll hear Gareth at 8 in his interview with the National Youth Development Agency.
I don't think people were craving it, Leanne.
It's going to be riveting listening. Yeah.
So that's Leanne Moll. She's here. Really last minute. You know,
yeah, Leanne, 20 past 5 call this morning, and so I'm here.
I don't really listen to the Thursday show because I try to stay away from politics because I find it depressing. I try to be upbeat. But Leanne's here. Pumi's not here today. But then the other voice you heard now was Kenton Pile. Now, someone who I have a great deal of respect for because he's a smart dude. Not only that, he's very, very eloquent. He has good ideas.
He's very opinionated, you know.
But the great thing is he also knows how to debate.
Coffee makes the world go around. What can I say?
All of these things and a lovely, sultry voice on top of all of that. Kenton, thanks for joining us again on the Burning Platform today.
Always a pleasure. Though I'm missing Sia being around here. I understand he's having quite a bit of fun out in the US, yeah. And he did not get racially profiled when he went in.
He didn't. Mm. He got sexually profiled by his host, but that resulted in going to the right kind of bars. So maybe not the worst thing.
No, yeah. Sia, never.
He exchanged numbers, so let's see how it goes.
If you did miss the first hour, Sia went to two gay bars in Washington, D.C., and he said this
under the watchful eye of his host, who he described as almost his mom going on a date with him.
Yeah, wingman Debbie. So shout out Debbie. If anyone's ever going to Washington, D.C. and you want to know the best bars to go to, Debbie's surprisingly going to be the one for you. All right, enough of this double-dabble. Kenton, we are in a very interesting week. Obviously, we prepared a whole bunch of talking points here. I would like to start, because it's something we touched on Monday, is Cyril Ramaphosa's visit to London, or his journey for foreign investment, selling the country, reaffirming.
What exactly is he going to be selling?
Kind of like, you know, easing the tensions and disbeliefs about the future of SA. Obviously, it's a big job. I mean, it really is. It's like the Proteas coming back and asking for sponsorship for World Cups. It's a difficult thing to do. What's your take on this? Is this
Yeah, I don't know if you guys noticed that his tone in terms of how he was addressing people out there and the amount of stuff he was willing to share seemed to be a lot more open than the kind of stuff that he talks about back home.
Would that be because he's got a bit more confidence when he gets into these positions, or is he in more control of his job? I don't exactly know.
Maybe, you know, back home there's a greater sense of needing to pander to specific audiences at a given time.
Completely, or and, just the ANC.
Yeah. I think here, pretty much wherever he goes, I mean, this morning, for example, he's out in KZN opening a mobile phone factory that costs more than R1 billion. And, you know, I expect that the kind of stuff that he's going to have to deal with while he's opening this mobile phone company is going to be talking about what's going on in ANC KZN, which, as we all know, is in a complete state of disarray
really
right
dodgy.
Now.
Actually, yeah.
So, but yeah, going back to the whole thing in terms of London, I think that to a large extent, he was actually ticking a number of boxes appropriately around persuading people that he knows what he's doing. But the more interesting thing for me was the stuff that was happening behind the scenes. And I have this really strong feeling that Ramaphosa is now, for the first time as a South African leader, engaging very positively with the Americans.
Which is kind of encouraging, being the superpower that they are.
Yeah, what kind of makes me think this is because Trump essentially authorized putting the Guptas on the Magnitsky list, which is hugely significant. Mm. Effectively, what it means is that these guys are not able to travel in many parts of the world. They're not able to spend their money anywhere in the world. Well, not legally anyway, because we all know that the U.S. effectively is the gatekeeper of the international banking system.
Yeah.
Because in terms of SWIFT, which ostensibly is based in Belgium, but in fact every dollar-based transaction has to go through the U.S.'s approval system. And if you happen to have been flagged by Uncle Sam, at the point at which that transaction actually hits, they will just simply confiscate your money.
So I was wondering how it actually happened. I mean,
yeah, I'm glad you gave the rundown.
How does it get picked up?
Well, it gets picked up because essentially there's, well, I don't know if you guys have ever been in a scenario where you've needed to get money from outside the country, but
it's not the easiest thing.
Well, it's relatively easy for most parts of the civilized world. We have difficulties in our country because we have forex controls in our country, which, you know, free countries don't have. You know, so Kenya, for example, doesn't have forex controls. You can take your money in and out of the country as you see fit. Botswana doesn't have forex controls. You can take your money in and out of that country. But we, of course, have forex controls because it goes back to an apartheid mentality which says that money would flee the country if given a chance,
right,
which is correct because money likes to be free. And then when the ANC came into power, the ANC said, well, the number of white South Africans will take their money out of the country, so we're going to keep exchange control in place. But you're moving aside from that, going back to the way in which SWIFT works, which is the Society for Withdrawals Interbank Transfer. I forget, but that's the acronym. But they are headquartered in Belgium, and effectively all global financial transactions move via SWIFT. But what this effectively means is that if you are flagged on SWIFT, it becomes really difficult for you to do transactions. So that's how the U.S. enforces sanctions on people like Iran, on people like Cuba.
Yeah, yeah. That's quite a force being like imposed.
It's absolutely phenomenal. And you see, it's one of the reasons why you've had the uptick in terms of things like cryptocurrencies. Because cryptocurrencies are not reliant on the U.S.'s goodwill. So, you know, I am one of these people who believes that money needs to be free. You need to be able to move it where you see fit.
Free as trade, yeah.
Exactly. And but in the case right now around the Guptas and the Magnitsky Act, which is, you know, just, you know, we could touch on that at some point. But effectively, it was named after a Russian who was killed by Russian goons, you know, who ultimately are reporting to Putin. But, you know, we'll put that aside for now. And he had a very close friend who was Bill Browder, who's a U.S.-based investment banker, who then lobbied Congress to pass a bipartisan act that was called the Magnitsky Act, which basically says that anyone on that list gets treated as a human rights abuser or a terrorist and is then treated in the same way as countries get treated in terms of being embargoed on
SWIFT. This sounds like a good movie waiting to happen.
Yeah, absolutely.
Very much so.
I mean, that is a fantastic thing to be able to do. But now, I think just judging from what I've skimmed through is that when Cyril went and gave these big talks and that kind of stuff, one of the things was he was actually asked about the Guptas. And he was asked about the corruption. He was asked about how he's bringing that all in line, to which he doesn't have a lot of answers to that, obviously. He said he'll do everything he can to make sure these people are brought to book, obviously, after what this U.S. Act is now enacted. But, like, where is the next step, though? Sure, these guys are now going to be sort of even more pigeonholed into Dubai, whatever it is.
Well, the next step now is our government's fast-tracking the implementation of the extradition treaty with Dubai.
Ah.
Which, again, becomes kind of interesting because, you know, on the assumption that Dubai actually agrees to that, and given that, you know, when the U.S. has jumped, Dubai generally says how high.
Well, yeah, that's the thing, because now you'd be able to start the conversation by saying, okay, so we've got this.
Yeah.
How about we just get this now?
Yeah. So I think that that's going to be the next interesting phase. And the question then becomes, right now you've got the Guptas, well, the three Gupta brothers and Salim Issa, the four people who have been put down on the Magnitsky listing, which means that, you know, they're billionaires, but they're not able to spend their billions. Mm. You know, so if they put down a credit card, you know, a dollar-based credit card, it's going to get instantly declined. But there are a number of other countries around the world that also have their own versions of the Magnitsky Act. That's one of the things that Boris was referring to in the Queen's speech earlier this week. So one can expect that the Guptas will soon be flagged in the UK as well, in addition to to the EU.
Shame.
And it's going to be pretty much a case of there's nowhere left for them to run.
Mm.
Well, speaking of running out of options, Jacob Zuma said he is being victimized because he is black. That doesn't sound, I mean, like, this guy's running out of options. He's running out of excuses. He's running out of all kinds of things.
Yeah, except
he was addressing his supporters this week.
He plays that particular card in appropriate audiences. And if you consider that it was the BLF guys with Andile, unpronounceable surname, who was there cheering him on. yeah, there you go.
But when he's cheering you on, maybe your subject matter is not so great. So he's he made an appearance on Tuesday at Peter Marisburg High Court. So obviously we're going to go ahead now and skip more out of this his corruption stuff. Is that also coming to
it? Well, remember he's now taking it. He's now put in for an appeal, which means that appeal is now going to be held in February. So until then, you know, nothing's actually going to happen on the corruption trial.
Until Feb.
So what I expect will happen is that come February, and look, I don't want to second guess the judiciary here, but this was a full bench of the Peter Maritzburg High Court that ruled against him last time. So, and they are effectively going to hear the appeal on, I think, Feb 20th is when it's coming down.
But Kevin, sorry, I'll stop you right there because I just feel like this is a story that's just gone on and on and on. As a South African citizen, I think you should have a certain amount of appeals, right? You know, like in Test cricket, you get the referrals.
And let's also remember this stems from 2005.
Yeah, but Leanne, he appeals everything, right?
Yeah, but
where there's smoke, there's...
Look, that's the Stalingrad defense. And what the point that Zuma makes all the time is, look, I'm exercising my constitutional rights as a citizen. And he's absolutely correct in doing that. And
taking advantage.
Yes, look, the wheels of justice grind slowly, but they do grind. And I think my prediction in terms of what's going to happen is when we get to February 20 next year, we'll see that the judges will turn around and say that your right to appeal is denied because there's no reasonable prospect that another court would come to a different decision. In which case, the only option then left to Jacob Zuma is to then appeal directly to the Constitutional Court.
Probably won't go so well.
Well, I don't know. But if you take a look at the judgment, and I waded through, it was about 70 pages. It's you know, kind of a blow-by-blow account of...
This guy's been responsible for devastation of forests. I mean, Mpumalanga is poorer because of Jacob Zuma's court case, if nothing less.
Well, Nkandla is poorer because of Jacob Zuma. You know, let's be clear about this. In his own backyard, people decided that he was not good enough for them, and that's now an Nkandla municipality. It's now an IFP municipality,
yeah.
Nkandla
is.
So, yeah, but going back to the Constitutional Court, based on the judgment, if you read through it, I don't think that there's a reasonable possibility that the Concord will take the view that his constitutional rights have been violated, at which point you know, the trial then starts in earnest.
But Kenneth, an innocent yet decent question is, how is he paying for this still? How is he still managing to go through?
Because
this stuff is not cheap.
Yes,
like he's still going into these appeals and this kind of stuff. Like he's got the Gupta's money. Was there that much? Did he have a legal slush fund developed?
Well, I don't know actually what the scenario is. I don't know who his current crop of lawyers is, because remember that I think, what is his name? Michael Hulley was the guy who was his lawyer for a number of years.
Yeah.
Who is no longer there, and I assume that's because access to a legal flow of money has now stopped.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm pretty sure that he'd be in a position to continue paying lawyers with bucket loads of cash, because I'm pretty sure that there's lots of it stashed all over the place.
As in cash.
Yeah, but it's really difficult for lawyers to make use of cash. I mean, you know, seriously, what are you going to do with cash? You know, you can't even pay your bond with cash because...
This is true.
Yeah.
So sticking kind of in the Zuma thing, Minister of Cooperative Governance and Traditional Affairs. Gosh, that's a ministry I haven't heard about for quite some time. But of course, that isn't Nkosazana Dlamini-Zuma. On Saturday, blamed corruption and infighting in municipalities on the lack of skills and opportunities in local government.
No shit, Sherlock.
my thoughts exactly. And something that Gareth has brought up a few times. But like, where's the relevance in her now? I mean, she obviously... Cyril beats her at the coming of ahead of the two factions of the ANC. She's then just given a ministry as like a, well, here you go, have that. But like, how newsworthy, how relevant is this woman now going forward in the political landscape?
Look, I have a very contrary view in terms of Nkosazana Dlamini-Zuma. I mean, you know, the big thing in favor of Nkosazana Dlamini-Zuma for me is that she divorced Jacob Zuma.
Fair call.
Yeah, so... so at the point at which people were turning around and saying that she's going to be a Zuma acolyte, my take on that was, well, actually, I don't think so. I think that she actually loathes him. Remember that she was also on...
She's kept his name, which is interesting.
Well, you know...
I mean, we would recognize who she was if she was called Nkosazana Dlamini.
Maybe she's doing it for the kids.
Yeah, no, that's pretty much what the case is, because remember that she was part of Team Mbeki when... the ANC basically imploded Polokwane in 2007.
Oh, right, okay.
And in fact, but prior to that, at the point at which Mbeki fired Jacob Zuma as deputy president of the country, he wanted to actually bring Nkosazana in as his deputy president. But Nkosazana then turned down the offer because of she didn't want to upset her kids. Mm. And that's what she said at the time.
Sure.
So, I think, you know, let's park that stuff aside. I think if you look in terms of assessing ANC ministers over the course of their tenure in various positions, I think that, well, Trevor Manuel's record as finance minister, whatever you may think of what he's currently doing at All Mutual, he had a stunning record as finance minister.
Mm, sure.
You know, consistent economic growth, consistent tax cuts, all of the things that, you know, red-blooded capitalists like myself absolutely love. But if you take Nkosazana Dlamini-Zuma, the point at which she took over Home Affairs and, you know, completely ripped that institution apart and put in place, effectively digitized it, and what that meant was that we had a period where Home Affairs actually functioned very, very well.
Wow.
And then, of course, when we had Jacob Zuma going into office, at that point, it was necessary to capture Home Affairs in order to fast-track illegal visa applications for the Guptas so that they could do things like bring in slave labor from India in order to drive things like ANN7 and so forth. And, you know, so she was effectively sidelined during that period. And then they shipped her off to the African Union so that she couldn't stir stuff around back here. So,
color me educated. That is interesting.
Yeah. But so now going back to the question of, you know, lack of skills in municipalities. Sure. I mean, the Auditor General reports, you know, over the past decades have been saying this for the longest time.
But there's no one acting on it. And now, obviously, she bring up good points. But as you say, like, no shit, we can all see this from a mile away.
Yeah, well, you see but if you look at what's actually the end result of this, that you have all of these municipalities which are collecting rates, and then the rates don't get spent on things that they're meant to be spent for, and people just simply stop paying rates, which means that you now have the scenario that you had in Newcastle a week and a half ago where they were unable to pay their bills, and they eventually had to end up in court with Eskom, and they've now struck a deal to pay $30 million a month back towards Eskom. But all of that is...
Just $30 million a month.
Yeah, well, it's a drop in the ocean compared to... Eskom's current debt? About $600 billion or something like that.
See, but this, again, from someone who doesn't spend a lot of time in politics, you look at Cyril Ramaphosa, he's obviously got his flaws, and people were saying, like, you know, he made the statement this week that 500 billion rand was basically lost under the Zuma administration through corruption.
Well, I think he said, in fact, it's closer to a trillion.
Yeah.
You know, which again is quite refreshing, because, you know, instead of trying to whitewash it, you know, he's actually turning around and saying, well, it's actually,
To which people say, yeah, but you presided over that as deputy president and didn't really do a whole bunch. And then you look at, like, okay, so there's those kind of bigger issues. And then you look at this kind of, like, on a municipal level. It's like, how does he fix this? Because clearly these people who are responsible for it are only making it worse and worse and worse. So it's like, you know, where are his strong allies coming towards that he can actually just worry about the big stuff and know that the structures are helping him? Because at the moment, it just seems like it's the rot is so deep. Like, how do you turn around? He can go and talk to people overseas and have these great plans, but I mean, he needs a lot of people singing from the same song sheet.
Yeah, well, the difficulty in terms of fixing the municipalities is that that is the ANC's patronage network.
Sure.
And that's the reason why people literally kill each other for those positions. I mean, if you go to a municipality like NMBT, Ladysmith, mm-hmm. where they, you know, literally councillors killed get killed month by month.
Yeah. I mean, it's worse than like the Colombian drug trade.
yeah. So, because the fact of the matter is that the salaries that you end up drawing as a councillor, you know, effectively make you the biggest person in town, just simply based on the rampant poverty that's all around there. And so people literally kill in order to get to those positions. So I don't know how one actually starts fixing that without having a complete redraw of the constitutional framework of how those things are run. But of course, the problem for that is that when you have municipalities that are purportedly well run, well, Cape Town, for example, would generally claim that they're a well-run municipality.
Sure.
I disagree at a number of levels, but...
But when you compare apples to...
Exactly. And do you really then want a situation where you're removing the power from the municipalities to make their own financial decisions and take that back into central government? I don't think so. So
it's not sustainable, no.
Yeah, but I think the ultimate reality is going to be the complete breakdown of those municipal structures. But more importantly, you'll increasingly see a lot of the stuff getting privatized. So if you think in terms of...
Which is always the most obvious solution.
It is. Yeah. So if you look at a scenario like... let's take Waterfall, for example, right here in Midrand, which is, you know, effectively...
It's still growing. I drove past it yesterday. There's another phase.
It's growing at a rapid rate.
Yeah,
but it's effectively a private municipality, if you think about it.
Yeah.
So they're still paying rates and taxes back to the official megacity governments. Mm-hmm. But effectively, that's just a tax to say, get out of my way, and we're going to continue to just build things here that actually function. So, you know, we're putting up hospitals, we're building the roads, we're setting up the schools, and all of that kind of stuff. I think we're going to see increasingly that happening in many parts of the country. If you look in terms of the Eastern Cape, for example, there are a number of former municipalities where the people themselves have basically gotten together, they've kicked out the governments, and they're running it in old school way with village councils. And I think that's great.
It's great. Yeah. Anything where you get a sense of community that's actually working together, not apart, that's great.
Absolutely, yeah. So, you know, so going back to this thing about Dlamini Zuma's words at Drakensberg last week. By the way, just, you know, the entire concept of that Drakensberg gathering was kind of interesting. In of itself, but you know, we'll go back to that in a second. But I think that it actually was an opportunity for a lot of them to kind of come clean in terms of their thoughts, because it wasn't within the constraints of an ANC formal structure,
correct? Yeah.
Which basically restricts what people are able to say. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, it's not within the constraints of a public forum, because you know there was this very real sense of, hey, we're all friends here.
So if there's a time to find your voice as a politician,
yes.
Here it is. Yeah.
Yeah. So we had lots of people coming out of the woodwork back then and expressing. I mean, Alec Irwin, for example. You know, we haven't heard from him since that.
It's been a while.
Since the lost bolt at Kuberg, you know, a decade ago. But very interesting stuff that was coming out of this entire gathering, just in terms of steering the conversation in a different direction.
Sure.
Yeah. So, you know, cynical me, I'm still seeing these little glimmers of people wanting to grow a spine at in various levels.
But the idea of communities taking the power back, it's just, you always feel like as long as there's enough money in places for people to actually do that kind of stuff. Like we look at Orderfall, obviously that's a top-end kind of LSM thing, so they will be able to do things. How people can galvanize each other in smaller, less like fortunate kind of places, less privileged places, whatever, that'll be the big test.
Yeah, but if you think about it, the logistical needs of small municipalities are really not that huge.
Good point, yeah.
If you think about it, right now for most of the small municipalities, the most critical need that they need to overcome is fresh water. And if you can actually ensure that your water is flowing so that your sewerage needs are actually taken care of, that's the most fundamental level of basic human comfort that you need to take care of.
Yeah.
So if you can first address that very basic level in terms of sanitation, then and you look in terms of keeping your schools going, and then of course find a way to keep the lights on. And essentially, if you can address just those very simple things in small municipalities, people can generally end up making a plan. But when you have a complete disintegration of those core things, which is what's happening in many of these smaller municipalities, that's when the country falls apart.
It would be so nice to listen to what you just said and said, like, this sounds stupid. What do you mean you can't do that? Like, there's so many people who take all that kind of stuff for granted. And here we are in so many places of the country where there's, as you say, like, as long as they can do this, but it's been such a challenge up until this point.
Yeah, well,
I mean, this week with the load shedding coming back as well, it's just like hits home how difficult this still is.
Yeah, well, you know, when we had the last batch of load shedding not so long ago, and I went out and actually dropped more money on extended battery capacity for my UPSs so that, you know, hey, the lights go off, but at very least my Wi-Fi keeps working.
Mm. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, Catherine, just touching Eskom while we do have it. I know we spoke about it earlier in part one, but do you think these conspiracy theories of like, okay, so Cyril's out of the country and then there's like suddenly there's just this maintenance has fallen down. Do you believe any of the conspiracy theories around the fact that these guys do actually plan these outages and they do it for like strong arming the public?
No, I've got this thing called Kantin's axiom, which is never attribute to malice what is best explained by incompetence.
Well, there you have it.
All right, that's amazing.
Oh, gosh.
Okay, so going back to local government municipalities, the Durban Commercial Crimes Court has found that ex-Etaquini mayor Zandile Gumede breached her bail conditions. This woman sounds completely unhinged.
She did breach her bail conditions. However, the court said, look, it's actually okay because she's not a flight risk, and she had nominally put this down as one of the addresses where she has a business. So, you know, she didn't flee the country, and so there wasn't any intent to evade justice.
Oh, look,
so,
the exact same charges that Zuma faced, fraud, corruption, and racketeering.
Yeah, well,
you haven't politicianed unless you've got those three.
Yeah.
Look, the interesting thing here is that you actually had the asset forfeiture unit pouncing upon her space and a number of other spaces. So there's actually a little bit of a step by step thing happening that we can see. But I don't know if you guys caught Shamila Batoy in Parliament yesterday.
No.
Well, one of the things that she said was that there are 700 vacancies for prosecutors.
700 vacancies?
Yeah. You know, and I was looking at this, I said, what the fuck? 700 vacancies?
Yeah.
Now, if you understand, you know, the net impact of that stuff on the overall ability of the criminal justice system to actually get stuff done, that's huge.
Is that because in old structures there's just 700 people left and were replaced, or has the need for prosecutors grown so much that now forecasting the
need? I think, you know, certainly vacancies would imply that these are just, you know, jobs that have not been filled.
It's not been filled.
Yeah.
700.
You know, so if you think effectively what that means is at very least, you know, assume that each prosecutor is going to look at least 4 cases per day. Then, you know, do the multiplier effect in terms of the overall impact on our not being able to police the country effectively.
Wow. And like, what happens? I mean, those things get delayed and, like, kind of forgotten about, essentially?
Well, again, you know, this actually requires that you have a functional bureaucracy that's attending to all of those things step by step. But when you have judges standing up and saying, fix the flippant air conditioning in this court because, you know, we can't sit. And it's that level of incompetence, and how do you actually start fixing that piece by piece?
So, Catherine, if you wouldn't mind, I want to go on to do something a little bit more every day. Barry Bateman, as someone who knows the media, and obviously I'm sure you know Barry.
Yes. I haven't seen his apology on Twitter because I don't follow him on Twitter, and so I didn't have access to his tweet. But I did see a lot of social media gossip around the fact that he had been made to apologize.
Okay, so yeah, I mean, that's obviously, it's ridiculous. I know his employer apologized straight away, and then he was obviously going to do his apology. I haven't really paid attention to that. But someone that we know very well here, Dr. Jonathan Witt, he put out a tweet this week basically talking about how Brad Bevan's been suspended without pay, which is a very strange South African thing, because normally when people get suspended in this country in political office, they get their pay.
Mm.
Anyway, so after calling Julius Malema a puss, which he's not the first or the last person to do so, let's be honest, he got suspended without pay. So Dr. Witt, he put out a tweet asking...
I'd find that difficult to believe that he was suspended without pay, because, I mean, certainly in terms of, you know, just our labor laws in this country, you know, he'd immediately be able to take that to the CCMA and get his money, and probably some additional compensation as well. So I'm not sure what Jonathan's source is for that particular thing. I'd find it highly unlikely that Prime Media would suspend someone without pay.
Well, you would think Prime Media wouldn't want any more controversy around this thing. They'd want to kind of just keep everything a little bit quiet.
Well, yeah, look, I mean, it's one thing trying to avoid the controversy, but you know, essentially I'd like to think that nearly all companies in this country actually try and play by the rules as far as possible.
Well, you'd hope, not be too strong-armed by the wokeness of, like, outrage on Twitter.
Yes, you know, because that's certainly not going to be a defense in the labor court. But... But essentially, I'm not sure what the resolution was, you know, because, you know, frankly, I haven't listened to 702 in for probably a heck of a long time. I think, you know, I do tune into, you know, Cummies on Cape Talk whenever I possibly can. But by and large, the conversation that takes place on 702 is just so inane that I just cannot cope with it.
Well, I think when Eusebius Mkhize becomes the poster boy on all the billboards that they have around
who?
Town, Eusebius Mkhize.
Who?
I
all right, moving on.
Exactly. When he becomes a poster boy for your billboards in prominent areas, I don't think you got the greatest quality of broadcaster / content. So anyway,
but you know, going back to Bateman, I think if you consider, if I have to take an overall view in terms of where Prime Media's strategy is in terms of trying to win over listeners going forward, I think they took a very DA approach, which is to say we're basically going to drop our old white audience, aka John Robbie, and or in the case of the DA, Helen Ziller, and we're going to chase a new young black audience, which, you know, we believe is going to be woke, and which we believe is going to be you know, wanting to push particular narratives around white privilege and and taking money away from rich people. I think it's, you know, you're a private company. You should feel free to do whatever you see fit. But I think that's an inherently stupid thing to do. And I think that Power FM has certainly been lapping up the talented black market, if you want to put it that way.
Sure.
You know, certainly in terms of... people that I hear calling in when I do dip in every so often, you know, just to see where conversations are going. Power FM does seem to be attracting the black intelligentsia, if you want, you know, you want to call it that, or certainly upmarket black listeners.
Definitely, or as Jacob Zuma once referred to as the clever blacks.
That's and then if you look in terms of what Kaya FM is doing, you know, again, they are playing very firmly to that market, and it's not at the level of hysteria around you know, what white people are doing. They're just getting on with their stuff. They've got this narrative around, you know, around successful people and, you know, living good lives, and they've got David O'Sullivan on their breakfast show.
He's still there, but now David Goliath, one of the Goliaths.
Yes,
so many is also there.
Jason Goliath.
Sorry, just I just wanted to just touch on the thing with Barry Bateman. So obviously he was suspended, as reports have been suggesting, without pay. So Dr. Jonathan Witt put a tweet out with his banking details.
Yeah,
that
he did.
Obviously
he said
he's going to battle now. He's not getting paid to, you know,
make ends meet, he said.
Yes, so he put his banking details out there, and then he had to delete the tweet to which he then said, I've deleted my tweet about crowdfunding for Barry Bateman. A target has been reached, which is in line with his monthly salary, and as a result, no further funds are required. Thank you to everyone who so generously contributed.
This whole thing is such a joke, honestly.
But that is so wonderfully efficient, look, Dr. Wood.
Look, guys, I think, you know, we must recognize Twitter for what it is. It's kind of a town square, but you know the fact is that if you take a typical town square anywhere in the world, it's people who either are rich enough to not have to work, or people who are unemployed who actually flock to the town square, and people who actually are earning a living don't actually have time to participate.
Yeah, because they're busy.
Yeah, because they're busy.
Yeah, you got some fantastic analogies this morning. So something I do want to touch on. Those are your kind of like big kind of talking points right now in the political world. Pumi was here on Tuesday and said basically that day zero was invented by Tony Leon. And she then obviously went on to say that there has been a lot of talk about this last year even, and that Tony Leon is trying to kind of get Musi Mamani out of the DA. First up, is Tony Leon still someone who has clout, power, reach, influence? Is he like the Tony Blair of the Cape?
Look, I certainly think that if you look in terms of Tony Leon's life, does he have any vested interest at all in terms of being a power broker in the DA? I think the answer to that is probably not.
Sure.
But on the other hand, if you consider that Tony Leon triggered the single biggest growth in terms of support for the DA, and then Helen Zille pretty much built upon that success.
Yeah. So like DP, DA, was it DP?
Yeah, Walt was the DP under Tony Leon. Yeah. And then, and again, you know, his stuff up was that he then went into a merger with the Nats, mm-hmm. which then fell apart. And then the Nats left the DA and merged with the ANC. But, of course, everyone forgets that, and everyone says that the DA is the party of the party.
Except for Martinus van Schalkwyk with Kurt Brook.
Yeah, Kurt Brook became a minister under Thabo Mbeki. I think he's still an ANC MP, Kurt Brook. Yeah, but let's not talk about Kurt Brook for now. But certainly in terms of Tony Leon, you know, given that he, you know, put significant investment into actually building up that party, would he have an interest in having it get back on track in terms of his perspective? I think the answer to that is probably yes.
Sure.
But
we could have another "Ha, I'm Tony Leon" advert coming soon.
Well, but also the, you know, the other thing, of course, is Helen is now back in the running for, you know, federal chairperson.
Yeah. Yep.
And that's happening this weekend. Look, I certainly think that there was a lot of dissatisfaction with the direction that the DA ended up taking, because
completely, especially with ANC just giving them so much time to like to look good,
yeah,
and then they still didn't get the growth they needed in the last elections.
And I think if you look in terms of where that growth actually went to, I think that the Freedom Front Plus effectively ended up picking up all of that. So you know, I don't expect Musi Maimane to last. Let's put it that way, because. And it's not on the basis that, you know, a lot of people are saying that it's a race agenda. No, I actually think that it's far more likely that it's on the basis that he's just failed to build on the DA support base.
Completely, but it's like one can re-debate that.
So
facts are facts.
Yeah, so you know, if you take a political party backwards, you know, generally the leader steps down.
But now where is the next step? Because same thing happens in sport, the same thing happens in business. Generally, there's a play for succession.
My view in terms of the DA really, it actually hasn't changed, you know, for the past couple of decades. Even if you took a look at the DA's trajectory under Helen Zille, you know, so let's say it was showing a steady growth of, let's say, 8% per year, if it was building that. Remember, 8% is not 8 percentage points, guys, so let's not. So if they're building on their support base by 8% per year, the trajectory in terms of how long it would take them to become the party of government would, you know, be at least another 20 years. Yes. You get my logic. So
Moosey will be 59 by that stage.
Yeah. Prime so fruit. So the question really is, you know, is the DA, should the DA be focusing on actually building a solid principle support base where people always are aware of what they stand for, or just simply trying to compete in the ANC's own backyard? But, you know, the only difference being, well, you know, we actually support everything that the ANC supports, except we are not corrupt.
See, that's an interesting question, because that's what I think about as well, is that in politics, because it's a game of popularity, it's quite juvenile in that respect, especially here in this country. Is there any way the DA could get in charge outside of that? And you made your own point there. You could either be policies, which will never get you the mass votes, or you can just be a less shit ANC.
Well,
ANC light, as some people have called the DA.
See, but a different question to ask is, you know, are we ultimately destined for coalition politics? And the answer to that is yes. Now, coalition politics works.
Which just sounds scary in many other ways, because the EFF are generally going to be involved in those too.
For sure. But, I mean, if you consider the coalition that Helen Zille built together in the Western Cape back in the day, which was, it was a ragtag coalition of, you know, of rats and mice parties, but she was able to actually hold that together and build that up on the basis of actually working on principles at the time. A very different approach taken by Herman Mashaba in Johannesburg.
Yeah.
Because he basically tossed out a lot of the principles that the DA purportedly stands for just in order to get the EFF support, ostensibly so that he can do things for the city of Johannesburg. And I think that if you take the first approach, in the long term, it actually pays real dividends. Because as long as you don't compromise the principles that your party stands for in terms of what you're doing, ultimately the voters are going to keep backing you, and hopefully you can grow your power base.
Well, it's just for peace of mind. You know what you're working on every single day.
Yeah.
Which is also quite nice.
Right. Now, so my view is that if you look in terms of the ANC's trajectory, which again is a steady decline, I think the ANC's trajectory is far more interesting because, and again, this is a particular drum that I've been banging on for years, that the point at which the ANC drops below 50%, that's the point at which the country starts functioning. Because then if the ANC wants to pass a budget, for example, it means that they have to get buy-in from an opposition party that has enough casting votes.
Right.
So, you know, in some cases, if they want to pass a budget, for example, that's going to, I don't know, what's something that the DA would support but that the EFF would not support?
NHI, land, it could be yours.
Yeah, well, that's all of the stuff that the EFF is likely to support. But let's say the ANC is passing a bill that's going to, I don't know, open up foreign direct investment.
Okay.
And, you know, then the DA is likely to vote with them on that particular issue. Then on the question of putting forth a presidential candidate, it does mean then that whichever presidential candidate that the ANC puts forward, because they'll still be the biggest party, let's be very clear about that.
Sure.
But in order to elect a president, they would then need to get the support of either the DA or the EFF.
But this is good. This is suggesting accountability, which is one of those factors that's very much lacking.
Right. But I guess what I'm trying to get to in terms of this entire thing around the DA and Moosey Maimane, and you know, frankly, it doesn't make a difference to me who's running the DA, because I think that what the country needs is actually a base of parties that are actually principled, where you know what they stand for at any given stage.
Yeah.
And if we build a long-term culture of accountability at that level, and then eventually the country functions.
Great, because I'm all for principles over personalities anyway.
Yeah,
for sure.
I mean, this whole identity politics crap, and we've seen that's going nowhere. I mean, we're getting up to the American elections soon as well, where we're going to see all this shit coming out.
Yeah.
And then it's, for me, it shouldn't be the circus. It should be something that runs and operates like a service. I mean, obviously the media have a decent amount to play in this. But stop the sideshow. Stop the pantomime of all this kind of crap. I don't care about Moosey Maimane either. I don't care if he doesn't own his house. I don't care if he's got a white wife. I don't care. All that kind of stuff. It's not important. But just while we're on that topic, how long do you think Herman Mashaba is going to be in charge of here?
3 weeks.
3 weeks. Mm-hmm. You reckon he's got 3 weeks?
Yep.
And then what? Because there's a guy who is, he's a polarizing character. But as you just said now about the whole principles of being in a place, I mean, it gives a lot of insight into who he really is then.
I don't really know who Herman Mashaba really is anymore because, you know, there used to be Herman Mashaba who was chairman of the Free Market Foundation. And, you know, disclaimer here, I still give money to the Free Market Foundation because, you know, I generally support
the principle you care for.
The principles that they stand for, even though, you know, I mean, Leon Doe is, you know, he does sound so tired and bored whenever he's standing up now at their discussions. But, you know, Herman Mashaba is chairman of the Free Market Foundation, self-made business person.
Sure. Well, Black Like Me was his big product, was it? Brand, company.
Yeah. Well, the hair care products. Yeah. I'm not the target market. But anyway, ever since he got into government, you know, he's had this obsession with inner city rejuvenation, mm-hmm. which is good because sure. I want to see the inner city actually rejuvenated. But that has come at a cost of not actually addressing the very basic level of service delivery that needs to take place among people who are actually paying their bills.
Right.
Because, you know, I'm the sort of person who says, you know, keep my lights on and keep my water running and all of that kind of stuff. And yeah, I'm happy for you to skim off some money for charity after that.
Yeah.
As opposed to taking all of it and skimming it off on inner city rejuvenation. But I think that, 3 weeks is what I'm giving him.
Very, very interesting. Just a couple of messages here before we go. I wonder if the Guptas will move their money through cryptocurrencies into clean money somewhere else. Obviously, Kenneth, that's something you touched upon. But, like, is that even possible? I mean, these guys have laundered so much, I'm sure. But is it possible that after all that they've done, they can still do something like that?
Well, you see, the difficulty now becomes how do you actually take, you know, all of this cash money, which, you know, I assume that they're sitting on. Oh, well, it's, you know, it's probably in a Dubai bank account.
Sure.
How do you actually get it out of the Dubai bank account right now? Well, I'm pretty sure that there are places that would be very happy to legally launder that sheer volume of money for a small fee. And, you know, if you consider, for example, that Putin has been buying massive supplies of gold, so he's been divesting himself of dollars. And
I would love to know what Putin's end game is. I mean, he's like Thanos of superpowers.
His end game is to actually cut out the U.S. financial system for exactly the reasons that I talked about earlier.
Right.
You know, in this particular case, obviously, the U.S.'s control of the international banking system works in our favor because they've gone after someone that we'd like to go after.
Yep.
But if you happen to be a country like Iran, which basically played by the rules and by every measure was actually doing its damnedest to become a positive global citizen, let's forget about the internal repression. We'll forget about their appalling record on women's rights and so forth. Because, frankly, nearly all of those Arab countries tick all of those boxes.
Exactly.
But Iran was making every effort to play by those rules. And then in what I think was a good deal brokered by Obama, and you have Trump coming along, and he just arbitrarily tosses that out simply because the Saudis are his friends. And which basically means that Iran is sitting on oil, and it just so happens that Iran has a quality of oil that we in South Africa are able to use. Hmm. Another discussion, by the way, because people keep saying Angola has oil. Why don't we buy oil from Angola? Nigeria has oil. Why don't we buy oil from them? Well, you know, there are different grades of crude oil.
Like, you know, sweet crude. And
yeah, there's light sweet. There's heavy and all of that kind of stuff. But essentially, our refineries in South Africa can only handle very specific types of crude. So we can't refine crude that comes from West Africa. We can't refine crude that comes from Angola.
And is that different to countries like the U.S.
Europe? Yeah, because Angola can actually export to the U.S. because they have refineries that are capable of handling that. So
would not be prudent just to get better refineries.
Yeah.
No, but no, the sheer capital cost involved in setting up those refineries, You know, and if you consider that we're on a global trajectory to using less oil, ultimately.
That's a good point.
Yeah, so the idea is right now, if you have to put down one of those new refineries, you never pay it back. It's kind of like the disaster that's Medupi.
Mm. Which is not having a good week this week.
Yeah, but it's never going to have a good week. We're never going to recoup the losses on that power station, just simply because your ability to charge electricity at a price that would be required to pay that off, when you look at the cost in terms of solar, which is following Moore's law, which drives computer chips, but also applies to things like solar panels and battery technology. So every day the cost of solar is decreasing almost exponentially,
whereas coal fueled electricity is
that's flat. So and you're never going to be able to charge the type of prices that you need to pay it off. So going back to the oil scenario again, we're never going to be in a position to put in place those new refineries. And again, it wouldn't make sense to put in place those new refineries. Mm-hmm. What would actually make sense is to expand on Sasol's capacity to some extent. But again, if I consider the capital cost that's involved there, I don't really know. Fuel cell technology, for example, is now going to be a thing, which is essentially driven by hydrogen.
Yeah.
So... but going back to the scenario right now, which is what we were talking about, which is essentially whether the Guptas can move their money around. Yeah, well, I think that a scenario is that probably someone like Putin would be very happy to take a few billion dollars off their hands in exchange for a substantial cut, of course, and potentially pay them in gold or rubles.
Something like out of a movie, this whole thing.
It is. It's a very dark world. Catherine, you are a terrific wealth of knowledge and insights, as always. Thanks for joining us today. That is pretty much wrapping it up for today on Cliff Central here on Thursday. Gareth and Sia will be back on Monday. But we are back tomorrow. Leanne, you here tomorrow?
I am indeed.
Fantastic.
I'll see you in the morrow.
Your persistence in the show is most admirable. I think there'll be other people, but if not, you'll still be in good hands with Leanne and I at the very, very least. Sorry I didn't get to all the messages. There's been voice clips as well, but it's a good hour. Wraps it up. Google did put the podcast up. I know there were some requests. It just took a couple of minutes longer today, and sometimes that happens. But either way, for this podcast and the previous ones from this week, cliffcentral.com. Google, do we have the thumbs up? Is that it? It's a wrap for a Thursday? Double thumbs up from all around.
Good. We're allowed.
Okay. Very good. All right. Cool. Catch you for tomorrow. Last day of the week. Leanne, I'm so excited about that.
Oh, man. So good. CliffCentral.com.